My name is Deanne Lagerquist. When I'm not at Holden Village, I teach religion at St. Olaf College. I am by training a church historian. And the things that I investigate historically tend to fall in the intersection of four groups. I'm a church historian. I mostly look at Christians, mostly Christians who are associated with the institutional church, although not entirely. I mostly work on the American setting, and that here I'm using that in the improper sense to refer to the USA. I often work with women, and more recently often with Lutherans, although that won't be relevant today. So you see in my title, American Religious Women, probably more truthfully I should have said American Christian Women. My subtitle, What is Our Past, I picked that as a sort of connector to the session I did earlier in the week on feminism, feminist Christianity, and oxymoron, where I suggested that the past is an important piece of our understanding of the present and the future. Also that to indicate that my questions about the past are largely formed on the basis of what's needed today. They're formed in the context of today's debates. Okay. So I suggested on, I think it was Monday, that the relationship between feminism and Christianity could be one of apathy, one of antagonism, or one in which there is some affirmation and mutual adjustment. And I really come down on the third option as a point where I see at least my understanding of feminism and my understanding of Christianity, that they overlap, they're not identical, often saying similar things in different voices. And given that relationship is always in flux as a historian, I find it very useful to look backwards, even as I think personally we often find it useful to look backwards to understand where we are and where we're going. Although one wouldn't push this too far, one might think of history as a sort of corporate therapeutic process. You know, that we're, how did we get to be where we are? Well, we got to be where we are because of where we were. And sometimes we have layers of the past. When you talk about women, different expectations of what women should do in their lives, we don't seem to get rid of any of them. They just lay one on the other. Okay. I think the past can provide us guidance both about where not to go and where to go. I think about this as I walk some of the trails around Holden Village. Sometimes there are markers showing you the direction, a little sign that says trail with an arrow. This year I achieved one of my longtime goals and I made it up to Copper Basin. A very patient, encouraging husband, and he went with me for 3 hours up. And when you go across these rock slides, there are little piles of rocks showing you which way to go. But there are also sometimes indications of how you should not go. If we go on the nature trail down here behind the village along the creek, it's a lovely little trail. And there are some places where there's a barrier because it looks like that's the trail and someone has put logs across. Don't go this way. This isn't the trail. If you go on the village loop, another underused, lovely little walk up around the village that way, you see this big sign at a, it looks like it's a trail up Martin Ridge, and it says, not an authorized trail. Right. So the past does both of those things for us. It shows us some ways to go that might be fruitful, might be useful, and sometimes it's a warning about, ooh, this didn't work before. You might want to be careful about this one. I also would suggest that the past can be an antidote to loneliness and discouragement. Many people often feel in their efforts to be who they are that they're the first person who's ever done this, that they're the only one who cares. And looking backwards, we can find that that's often not the case. That we aren't alone, that other people have thought these kinds of thoughts and wished these kinds of wishes. And so I think that's also very useful for loneliness and for discouragement. My master's thesis was about female abolitionists. One of my colleagues read it, and she said to me, one of her comments, it doesn't seem very angry, Deanne. I would expect more anger here. And partly, I think what's going on there is that I think the past gives us a different measure for progress. Certainly, we need to look ahead and see what remains to be done. But we need to look back and see what has been done, to see where progress has been made, so that we're not so discouraged. So on that copper basin trail, you know, when I said, oh, how much farther? I'm never going to make it. My husband is a little altimeter. 300 more feet of climb. Then I also had to think, well, look how far I've come. I'm almost there. To give up at this point would be foolish. Okay. So what we'll do today is take a fast trip over about, oh, not quite 300 years, arranged pretty much chronologically, but with some thematic subcategories, and partly organized by what I have pictures to show you of. There are a couple places when I didn't have any picture and I needed to say something, so we'll have those anyway, but those are how I've organized it. I've also written up some resources. If this catches your imagination and you want to read more, it's a growth field. There's tons of stuff out there. Where should you start? The first thing up there is edited by Rosemary Ruther and Rosemary Keller, both of whom teach at Garrett Evangelical Seminary in Evanston, where Peter Nash, who's doing the Bible study, teaches. Rosemary Keller has just become the dean there. They edited a set of three volumes, and I think the title is Women and Religion in America. It has those three words in the title in some order. And they're documentary, so that there'll be a section on, for example, Roman Catholic women in the 19th century. And there may be 5 or 6 or 10 little documents, but each one has an introduction to that section, and that's very interesting. Barbara McAfee has done this book called Her Story, Women in Christian Tradition. This goes all the way back to biblical images of women. So it's somewhat larger scope, but about half of it is on American women. And I noted there, it has a wonderful bibliography. It's no longer a really new book. It's 86, so there's, you know, almost a decade, at least half a decade worth of stuff that's not in here. But the bibliography is very good, and it's accessible. My colleague, Susan Lindley, is at work on a book that will just be on American religious women. It's going to be a very fine book. She was diagnosed with severe breast cancer this spring, but I heard from her. She's working on it. She's coming in every day and working on it, and I expect she will finish it. I expect she will live. She's a feisty woman. And that will be very good. So in a year or two, if you're in a bookstore and you see a book on American religious women by Susan Lindley, it will be worth buying. Then if you're especially interested in Lutheran women, I have done a little book called From Our Mother's Arms, taken from that hymn, Now Thank We All Our God. And that's available from Augsburg. So, and there's tons of other stuff, but there are just some places to begin. Okay. Everything we're going to say here today is post-Reformation. That is to say, Protestantism is an important part of it. Everything is influenced by the American context. And these pictures you don't need to see really closely. They're mostly background, so I'm just going to leave the lights on. Yeah, that's what I want next. I don't have a picture of a Puritan or a Pilgrim woman. So here you have a picture of William Bradford, the governor and historian of Plymouth Colony. Of course, the Pilgrims, the Puritans, they were dissenters from England who came to settle in the Northeast. We hear a lot about their search for religious freedom. I always caution my students that they were looking for religious freedom for themselves, not religious freedom as a general principle. Three things I'd like to say about the Puritan view of religion and how that affected women. One is that we find in their writings, their sermons, for example, a lot of use of nuptial imagery. This is something that we don't use a lot in the current time period. There's one place where we see it is in the hymn, "The Church's One Foundation is Jesus Christ, her Lord." He is, and it's this stuff of nuptial imagery about the church and Christ, that the church is the bride of Christ. In the Puritan writing, it's more that the soul is the bride of Christ. This is more in line with medieval mysticism. A consequence of that is that the wife in a human marital relationship is the model for an ideal Christian. Okay, so on the one hand, we may dispute their understanding of a right marital relationship. We may not like the way they organized it. At the same time, it's worth noting that the way they organized it, the woman was the model for the Christian. And so women had an advantage as Christians, that there was more continuity between their earthly familial role and their Christianity, their role as a Christian, than there was for men. Because men had to do this flip-flop. As the husband, they had to be like Christ, and they were supposed to be the head. But as a Christian, they were supposed to be submissive and humble. And so that's a very interesting thing about Puritans. Another thing that's interesting about Puritans and women and religion is that at least one, and I think probably more than one, of the Puritan divines, we call them, the preachers, thought that women were naturally more religious than men. One of the reasons he thought that was because of the danger of childbirth. Bearing children was an extremely dangerous activity. You could die from it easily. I was in labor 30 hours with my son, and then I had a C-section. And I said, this is the time when it's useful to be a historian. Because I thought, you know, if I'd been one of those Puritan women in labor for 30 hours, there was no C-section, and it was likely we both would have been dead, right? It happened a lot. Well, some Puritan divines said, it's realized that it's at those points of threshold times or crossing boundaries that our minds do turn to religion. And so they thought that women were naturally more religious than men. That's in contrast to what has often been said about women in Christianity. Tertullian, one of the early fathers of the church in about the 2nd, 3rd century, said that women were the devil's gateway. You know, that women were more easily, some of the medieval Dominicans thought that women were more easily seduced by the devil into witchcraft than were men. Well, the Puritans reversed that in a way. Okay, now to return to this thing about the Puritans not looking for religious freedom for everyone, one of the first really notable American religious women in our past is Anne Hutchinson. She was a Puritan. She and her husband immigrated, I guess we could say, use that word at that time, to Massachusetts Bay Colony following John Cotton, one of the Puritan divines, who preached about a covenant of grace. This was pushing the edges of Puritan covenant theology. And so that was suspect. Anne would invite groups of women to her house to talk about the sermon. And that was sort of okay. But then she began to push more and more. She had two trials. One was a church trial, one was a civil trial. And she was accused both of false doctrine or false teaching and of unwomanly activity. And those were understood to be closely related. Okay, that is a common theme in the history of Christianity. She was thrown out of Massachusetts Bay Colony, went to Long Island, where actually she was died at the hand of some indigenous peoples, not before having given birth to a premature deformed child, probably because of her advanced age. That's what we would say now. At the time, it was taken as evidence of her heretical person, right? That this was a sign that she had strayed from the way.
Why was she considered a heretic?
Because of her teaching about a covenant of grace. She was moving more toward, sort of away from the Calvinism of the Puritans, with a strong predestinarian understanding of God's salvation, and more toward a way of understanding salvation coming by grace, rather than not giving enough attention to a changed life. Okay. John Cotton, who was her teacher, backed off of that and didn't pursue it as much as she did. Okay. Another early American group is the Quakers. And Quakers, like the Pilgrims, are part of the radical wing of the Reformation. The mainstream of American Protestantism, Lutherans, Anglicans, Episcopalians, Presbyterians, we think of them as the moderate or the magisterial Reformation. Well, then there's this huge multitude of extraordinary groups that began in the 16th century. The Quakers come a little bit later. They're part of the spiritual party, and they emphasize the spirit or the light of God, which is in every person. That's at the basis of many of their innovations, many of the reasons that Quakers have been understood to be kind of radical. One of the things that it meant is that they allowed women much more authority than the Roman Catholics or the mainstream Protestants, or even many of the other radical groups, like the Puritans, who come out of the Radical Reformation as well. And so they allowed women to preach. Here you see a Quaker woman preacher. Quakers were, especially in the early colonial times, considered a subversive element in places like Boston. And so one of Anne Hutchinson's friends, it's really awful that I cut off this woman's head, is Mary Dyer. Mary Dyer became a Quaker in the U.S. She kept coming back to Boston and preaching. And they'd warn her, this is a capital offense. You know, one time we throw you out, two times we do this, the third time we kill you by hanging. Her husband and her son came and got her to try and get her away. She kept going back, and she was eventually then executed by hanging on the Boston Common. This is a statue of Mary Dyer, which is not on Boston Common, and I had to look so hard for it that by the time I found it, I have no idea where I found it, so I can't describe to you where it is in Boston. But there is this lovely statue of Mary Dyer, really a martyr to religious liberty. Okay. Another important group for our understanding of American religious women is the Shakers. I put this picture of Shaker dancing here, although it's a 19th century drawing, because the Shakers began pre-American Revolution. They were founded by a woman named Mother Ann Lee, who came to the U.S. with a few of her followers. She died as a result of a beating she received in prison. And her group took off, really grew a lot in the 19th century, but I've put it here because they came at this time. Some of the distinctive things about Shakers that are important for our understanding of American religious women are these. They understood sexuality and gender as an important part of life. They were not looking for an androgynous worldview or a gender-neutral religion. Gender was extremely central. What they were looking for was a complementarity which was equivalent. So that if any of you ever visited a Shaker village, some of them are now open as museums, this room would almost work. Certainly up there, all the buildings have an entrance for men and an entrance for women, right? The leadership structure is totally balanced. There's an eldress and an elder. Each position is balanced. And you can see it also in this worship. It's separate, but balanced. One of these villages that we visited in Massachusetts has the most wonderful photograph of the Shaker Sisters' saxophone sextet. And they told me that as the 19th century progressed and there were fewer and fewer converts to Shakerism, they came out of balance. And there weren't enough men to do these marches. And so they couldn't do them anymore. And so they evolved this other kind of worship, which included the Shaker Sisters saxophone sextet. But this was the preference, was that you'd have everything in balance. We, of course, think of the Shakers a lot because of their beautiful, simple furniture. The flat broom is one of their innovations. They also had an extraordinary theological innovation. They understood Mother Ann Lee to be the complement of Jesus, that Jesus was the male incarnation of Christ, and that Ann Lee was the female incarnation of Christ. So this balance. They were not very innovative with regard to men's and women's roles. The Shaker sisters worked in the kitchen, in the laundry, with the children. The men did the outside work. Okay, so they weren't innovative or radical with regard to roles, but they were innovative and radical in regard to the valuation of those. The other thing that Shakers are known for, and always makes my students sort of snicker, is that the inner circle of Shakers were all celibate. So they would have converts, families, and you could live in a family house, but as you moved into the community, that was renounced. And people will think, well, how did the Shakers ever survive? Actually, they survived very well, because every generation was a convert. This generation, there's never a second generation problem of people who were born to it and don't care about it. Okay, now what I don't have a picture of is anything having to do with the Great Awakening. In American religion, revivalism is a key factor. And the Great Awakening, just prior to the American Revolution, is the first major outbreak of that. Two things I want to say about the Great Awakening. One is that someone we would want to look at, if we were going to study this carefully to understand women's roles, is Sarah Edwards, Jonathan Edwards' wife. She was very important for Jonathan Edwards' understanding of what a revival was like, what conversion is, for the role of the affective life in religious life. Another thing is that unlike the Second Great Awakening, which comes in the 19th century, there seemed to be very little differentiation between men and women's experience of the First Great Awakening. So that there we can't really as easily read accounts of conversions blind and say, oh, that's a woman's and that's a man's. Okay. That will change in the 19th century, where for a variety of reasons, some of them economic, women's and men's roles are more and more differentiated. So that historians talk about separate spheres. I've always said it should be separate hemispheres, but the terminology is separate spheres. Here you see this lovely print of a woman within her compass. Okay, clear definition of what women do and what men do. This comes about as men begin to leave the home and go out into the workplace. I find this very useful to remember when people talk about women leaving the home and going out into the workplace, to remind us that men did that about 150 years ago. Right? It's not like it's women's fault that the family is in transition. It started to be in transition a long time ago. It's always in transition. Certain things then were given into women's responsibility. Religion is one of those. So that some historians have written about the feminization of American religion in the 19th century. That religion became the responsibility of women. And that religion came to be understood as something feminine rather than something masculine. And you can see some continuity there with some of the Puritan ideology. Of course, when we say this, we're talking about not necessarily the greatest number of people, but the people who were the culture brokers, if you will, of this time period. The most noted preachers, the most noted theologians, the people who were shaping the ideals, which is speaking prescriptively as much as descriptively. one of the most instructive efforts to understand this has coined the term the cult of true womanhood and identified the four characteristics of true womanhood in the 19th century as domestic, submissive, pious, and pure. Okay, remember this is prescriptive. This is what people are telling women they should be. Not all women did it, some because they didn't want to, some because they didn't have the opportunity to. If you were a black slave, really, you didn't have the opportunity to achieve these characteristics. Many immigrant women didn't have the opportunity to do it. Many working class women didn't have the opportunity to do it. Early in the 19th century, the second great awakening occurs, starting, well, of course, you can quibble about it. I'd say from about 1810 for about 30 years, period of awakening. The second great awakening included use of some new measures. This is a key phrase, new measures. Among these new measures was the idea that women ought to be able to pray out loud in public. This was a new thing. And it was controversial. Not everyone agreed with it. Some women even began not simply to pray, but to witness to their own experience and thereby to act as evangelists, so that a woman's voice was of equal value in this effort to convert others to any male's voice. So that as we understand the Second Great Awakening, it's important both for women as converts and for women as evangelists. Women as converts, we discover in the Second Great Awakening that at least in some locales, the proportion of male to female converts is something like 2 to 3. So women were being converted at a much higher rate. One way that this has been accounted for has to do with the loss of certain roles for women in society. Industrialization meant that some of the things women had done in the home, like spinning, were taken into a factory. And then a whole category of women who had a job that was productive no longer had that role in the family. We have this term, a spinster. Okay, who do you apply a spinster to? It's an old, not necessarily an old, it's an unmarried woman, right? Well, there used to be this role for unmarried women that they'd live in their siblings' households and they'd help with the kids and they'd have the job of spinning, right? It was a productive, important job. When it went into the factories, they no longer had that productive, important job. And if they got it hired, they probably didn't have a home, a family in which to live. And that liminal state, to take a phrase from a term from psychology, is often a time when people are vulnerable to religious change. If I can use vulnerable in a neutral sense, it's what we say about young college students, right? The first year, they're feeling real disoriented, and that's when they're likely to have some religious conversion. And some groups prey on that. They know that that's the case. Okay. Out of the Second Great Awakening come several important developments, some having to do with social reform. The impulse for this social reform is largely religious. This is contrary to what I said about Monday about what's going on today, that by and large, the mutual adjustment has gone from feminism to Christianity. In the mid-19th century, much of the effort to reform society came out of a religious impulse, not the other direction. One of the most noted kinds of religious reform is the abolitionist movement. Here you have a group photo of some important members of the American Abolitionist Society, and I put it up here especially because of this woman, Lucretia Mott. Lucretia Mott is one of my personal heroines. She's a Quaker preacher She was very involved in the abolitionist movement, the women's rights movement, educational reform, anti-war activities. She was noted as an extraordinary baker of blueberry pies and loved tacking rugs down and had a whole passel of children. She was like the original superwoman. And she seemed to have thrived on that. It's not so much but rather the holism of her activity, that she saw the connections between things. Many of the abolitionists understood part of the problem, right? They understood that slavery was bad. They didn't have a good sense, and I don't say this like we've got it, but from our place, we can see that they didn't really yet have an opportunity to understand some of the dynamics of racism that would still be there even when slavery was over. Lucretia Mott didn't understand it all, I'm sure, but when they moved out of the downtown of Philadelphia to what's not now a far-out place, but was then, the public transportation, there were horse carts that went, were segregated, and she refused to ride on them. She walked. So I'm especially fond of Lucretia Mott. She was a Quaker. And so for all of these things, that notion of the interlight was very important. Many others in the American Abolitionist Society came out of the Second Great Awakening and revival, that if I have been converted and I have been changed, then it is my responsibility to also change society and to convert society. This is Sojourner Truth. It's a watercolor based on a photograph. Sojourner Truth was, of course, an abolitionist. She was a former slave. And I put her up here partly because of the challenge that she made, a very direct challenge, to the cult of true womanhood. Lucretia Mott, in some ways, was very threatening, but in other ways, not very threatening. I mean, she had her husband was always there with her. He was pretty quiet, didn't say a lot, but he was supportive. He was always there. She had all these children. I mean, she could deflect some of the kinds of criticisms that there might be from people who thought women should act a certain way. I mean, she did stand up and speak to what were called promiscuous audiences. That meant both men and women were there. But Sojourner Truth took on that cult straight on in her very famous speech called Anti-Woman, in which she described her life, having born several children, having seen them sold into slavery, having plowed fields, not behind the plow, but sometimes in front of the plow too. Never being, she says in this speech, no one ever helps me into a carriage. And ain't I a woman too? She also, in this speech, makes reference to Christology, how we understand Jesus. She says, don't bring Jesus into this as the way to justify how you think women should be. Because as I see it, Jesus came from a God and a woman, and man had nothing to do with it. So, Sojourner Truth. Partly out of Quaker roots, partly out of the Second Great Awakening, and partly out of the abolitionist movement comes the women's rights movement. It's singular, women's rights movement of the 19th century. Here you see Susan B. Anthony, another Quaker woman who was the close colleague of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who came out of a revivalist movement. They saw a parallel as they worked in the abolitionist movement between the situation of slaves and white women. Some of them were better at distinguishing the differences as well than others, but they did see that. And out of that same religious impulse then that caused them to oppose slavery arose a women's rights movement that asked for women to have the same rights as men. Largely the white women who were involved with this were women of privilege, women whose families had property, so it made sense to ask for property rights. And The record of this movement is not unblemished. When we get to the early 19th century and begin to close in on women's suffrage, some of these women, I think I even have a picture of Anna Howard Shaw I'm going to show later, lost their sense of the similarity between their situation and that of the slaves, or people who were then no longer slaves, and began to talk about how it wasn't fair that the well-educated, knowledgeable, responsible wives of white men couldn't vote when black men could. When any immigrant from Ireland or Italy who just practically fallen off the boat could vote. So there was some real racist kind of rhetoric that finally achieved some of the goals. And that's part of the past that we need to look at carefully and say, gee, how did that happen? Why did that happen? Okay, another one of the reform movements that comes out of the Second Great Awakening in part is the temperance movement. And here you see some leaders of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, a group that people used to just laugh about, sort of mocking them. But recent historical work has rehabilitated them in large degree to see the strength of these women, their organizational skill, their vision. One of their most important leaders, National Officer Frances Willard, understood quite a lot about the connections between women's situation, the need for moral reform, the need for political reform. She saw all of those together. So she was an advocate of women's suffrage, not just of temperance. And they also saw some of the connections between, they weren't just against drinking because drinking was evil morally, but because they saw what it did to the social structure. Another little tidbit about the WCTU is I heard a woman lecture who had been working on the WCTU. She said the stuff that the WCTU put out early in this century on menopause was the best things that were written until the 1970s. Okay.
That was Carrie Nation?
Well, Carrie Nation was fringe, but it was this, the same movement, yeah.
Grandfather broke up
soon. Oh, yeah. My great-grandfather gave her a place to stay one night in Kansas. So she was all over. They had this, and their strategies are remarkable. You know, they do things like they go into a saloon and just sit there and sing hymns. They were very innovative. Another reform movement I didn't plan to talk about was the anti-prostitution movement. And one group in New York City had this strategy that they'd post someone outside of a known house of prostitution and write down the names of all the men who came out, and then they'd publish them in the newspaper.
The newspaper would publish.
Yeah, well, they found some newspaper that would publish them. Yeah. Okay, this is Anne Haseltine Judson. I have her up here because a very important thing that came out of that Second Great Awakening is the Protestant mission movement. Catholics have been involved in world missions somewhat longer, even going back to St. Francis. But starting mid-19th century, Protestants became more and more involved in that, partly because of a shift in theology away from predestination to a kind of theology that gave more importance to human agency in salvation, that one needed to take some part in that. So then it becomes more important to tell people the gospel so that they can respond. There are also some technological things like steamboats make it a lot easier to get places. Some political things like the opening up of China. Okay, well, Anne Haseltine Judson was an icon of the mission movement. She was the first wife of one of the first missionaries who was sent out from the U.S. They were in Burma. This mission movement gave an outlet for women's activity, for the activity that sprung from conversion, and for the skills that women developed in a variety of ways, including the opening up of education to them. Oberlin College, which is a direct result of the Second Great Awakening, was one of the first colleges in the United States to be coeducational. And women's education in places like Mount Holyoke and Smith and so forth was also growing. So you have this cadre of women who have evangelical zeal and education, and they need something to do with it, right? Well, the missions are one thing they can do with it. Some went, like Anne Hasseltine Judson, as wives of missionaries. Others went alone. This is Ida Scudder. I don't know if I can get her any more in focus than she is. That's getting worse, isn't it? She, there we go, was a physician. And this was another thing that women began to do in the 19th century, was to learn medicine. And many of them went overseas to do that, often as single women. I'm going to say something about the senders later. Let's look then at some other professional or quasi-professional things that women could do. I should have a picture. This is not, don't look at this picture for what I'm going to say. I don't have a picture of a pastor's wife, and I should, because the pastor's wife is a very important quasi-professional church role for women, going back at least to Katie Luther. Well, I mean, there were others at the same time. For Protestants, Katie Luther became a sort of model of the pastor's wife. And I think, following a historian who has said that Eleanor Roosevelt invented the job of the vice president, before Eleanor Roosevelt, the vice president had nothing to do but sit around and wait for the president to die. I think that the pastor's wife invented the job of the associate pastor. She did all the things that the associate pastor now does. And that's important to remember, and not to disdain that role. Another professional role for women in the U.S., of course, if you were Roman Catholic, was to be a nun. It was something that Protestants didn't understand very well. The Civil War helped, because there were a lot of Roman Catholic sisters who were nurses in the Civil War, and that was good for the general Protestant view of Roman Catholics. People got to know these sisters, and they were wonderful people, and that helped. Here you see a much more recent photograph indicating the important job that Roman Catholic sisters did in education. Not always under the best circumstances, in the best conditions, or getting the most respect, but nonetheless, an important role, and it gave these women an alternative to marriage and family raising. An alternative which was highly respected within their own religious community, something that Protestant women didn't really have. Starting in the mid-19th century, there was a revival among Protestants of an ancient church office, that of the deaconess, a revival and a redefinition. In the very early church, a deaconess was simply a male deacon and had responsibility generally in the church. Gradually, that was constricted so that a deaconess had responsibility primarily for things having to do with women. For example, using baptism by immersion, women, deaconesses, would be there to assist in the baptism of women, because when they came out of the water, you know, they could sort of, it was not modest, shall we say, and so they wanted a woman to be there to help with that. Starting about in the 1840s in Germany, there's a revival of the deaconess office, particularly among Protestants. Kind of a parallel to what Roman Catholic sisters did, often in education, nursing, or some kind of social service. And this was imported to the U.S. William Passavent, a very underappreciated Lutheran, was quite involved in this. He brought over several women and established hospitals with deaconesses running them. It's not a movement that ever got really big. It's a small number, but an important group of women, and there continue to be deaconesses today. Well, there you go. In some other groups, women had other kinds of roles. This is Phoebe Palmer. Coming out of the Wesleyan tradition, the Methodists, and the Awake and the Revival movement is something called the Holiness Movement. It has a spiritual basis, very much like the Quakers, and Phoebe Palmer was one of the most important leaders of that. So in those groups, which you might think of as sort of on the edge or fringy in some ways, at least the way we've done church history up until now. There seemed to be a role, at least for women, who could demonstrate that they had extraordinary spiritual gifts. Okay? That spiritual gift for preaching could overcome the barriers of being the wrong sex, or even being the wrong sex and the wrong race. This is Amanda Berry Smith, a former slave and domestic worker who partly with the encouragement of Phoebe Palmer became an important evangelist, not only in the United States, but also in West Africa, India, and Great Britain. So we have this other kind of roles. You have a pastor's wife, we have these celibate roles of deaconesses. No, it's no longer the case that deaconesses are celibate, but in the 19th and early 20th century it was the case, Roman Catholic sisters. And then these evangelists that have a spiritual base. By the late 19th century and early into the 20th century, some of the Protestant groups began to give women the office of ministry via education. Here's Antoinette Brown, who was ordained into one of the congregational churches. This means it's not simply that you have a spiritual gift, but that the church bestows on you the office, right? That you have the authority of the church, of the community, as well as the authority of the Spirit, which is powerful, but somehow, well, you know, it's hard to grab the wind. Then there's another group of women who are... could be grouped with Mother Ann Lee. They are founders or early leaders of what we sometimes call the new religions of the 19th century. This is Mary Baker Eddy, who is the founder, of course, of the Christian Science movement. Many of these groups, Shakers, Christian Science, I'm going to talk also a little bit about Seventh-day Adventists, had a high proportion of female membership as well as female leaders.
When you were in Massachusetts, did you see her monument?
Yeah, at the Mother Church. Yeah.
Well, and then in the cemetery in Cambridge.
No, I didn't see that. Yeah. This is Ellen G. White, who was not one of the founders, but one of the formers of Seventh-day Adventism. This group, the Shakers, Christian Science, and Theosophists, have several things in common that historians think might account for the fact that they had high female membership. One is that they had some peculiar understanding of marriage. They didn't go with the usual view. Their view of God tended to be less masculine. They didn't have such a hierarchical clergy, you know. So there are some similarities, and when you hear them, they sound a lot like some of the things that contemporary feminists are concerned about. At the same time, oh man, that's really awful. Mm-hmm. Well, you can almost see this is Evangeline Booth, one of the commanders of the Salvation Army in the United States early in this century. Sometimes it's surprisingly groups that we think of as quite conservative that provide an opportunity for women to take leadership roles, and the Salvation Army is one of those.
I was wondering if that was going to be here. My friend isn't here, was up here, couldn't be here today. She was wondering if we were going to bring this. Her mother was ordained as a pastor. She did the preaching. Her husband wasn't too good a preacher, but they were both ordained full way back.
Yeah, in the Salvation Army?
Yep.
There are other examples of women who had very visible leadership roles in groups that they founded or formed. Amy Semple McPherson is one of the most flamboyant in the Four Square Gospel Church. Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker Movement is another example, somewhat less flamboyant. About both of them, I would want to point out that they were exceptions. They were not systematic reformers with regards to women's roles. So that they themselves had leadership roles because of their exceptional abilities, but they did not make a system that was particularly attentive to the reproduction of female leadership. Okay, so if you look at the Foursquare Gospel Church today, you don't think, God, what a lot of women are leaders in this church. They didn't do that. They were themselves exceptions. And it's sort of on the same line as some of the notable women we think of in the history of Western Europe, like Elizabeth I, didn't change the system of government in Britain so that when you look at Parliament, there were a lot of women. There was just Elizabeth, right? Okay, now let's talk about some ordinary women. What did women who weren't in these professional public roles, what were they doing? This is the majority, after all. Many of them used their skills, what they had, to support the church and to support missions. This is a sewing circle. Women knew how to sew. They maybe didn't have access to a lot of cash, but they could sew, they could make butter. You read about groups where everyone gave the price of a pound of butter that they'd sold. Usually these groups, and therefore most Protestant churches have these at least by the 1920s. When you read their purpose statements, they are always external purposes, to support the gospel, to support the church, to support the mission, you know. They seldom say anything about what these groups do for themselves. And yet, these groups did a lot for their members. It's the place where you learned, like, how to be a wife, how to be a mother, how to make your bread rise if it didn't, how to think about the sermon on Sunday, because I'm sure they talked about that. They usually had some kind of devotion. Sometimes the pastor had to come and pray, because they weren't allowed to pray, because God knows what they'd pray for if they prayed by themselves. These were the women who provided the support in large degree for the female missionaries. And consequently, they learned a lot about the world. Gradually, these local organizations federated themselves in various ways, and the story in each denomination is a little bit different. But in a way very similar to what the reform movements did, the mission movement provided women in the church with an opportunity to learn organizational and leadership skills. How to run a meeting, how to keep a budget, all those sorts of things. This, the woman sitting against the wall is Catherine Lehman, who was for decades the president and executive of the Women's Missionary Federation, first of the Joint Synod of Ohio, and then of the old ALC. And she's sitting at the desk she's sitting at belonged to her father, who was the president of Capital University. So you think, you know, if she'd had other opportunities, she might have done other things. Not to demean at all what she did, but to realize that her options were somewhat limited. These groups eventually turned away from so much fundraising toward more education. Here you see some educational materials about that helps for the Ladies' Aid President, and it's about parliamentary procedure, how to run a meeting. Education was very important to these women's organizations, and at least in some of the Lutheran churches, I am convinced that they are really the origin of adult ed in the churches. They're the ones who have been faithful about Bible study, who have known about what the church is doing here and there and in the other place, and who have really provided the foundation for adult education in the churches. And this is something that I don't think we give enough credit for. Okay, what else did these women do? Well, of course, there's that entry point of baptism, being sponsors to children, the cradle role, looking out for the next generation, being nurturers of the faith. And in one congregational history I read, they tell about when they got a new font and the silver bowl that was to be in the font. You know, oh, here we have this big ceramic bowl, but this was a much more elegant arrangement, I imagine. It's some kind of marble pedestal silver bowl. And it says the bowl was given by, Anna Maelstrom, and it was fitting that she did because she had carried 30 children to the baptism or something like that. You know, I'm making up the figures and the name. But the point is that's a really important role that women have had in the church, to nurture not only their own children, but other people's children in the faith.
Peter talked about that in the Bible study Tuesday, too. That's really a forgotten role by the church.
Right.
It's to nurture, to be sponsors of each child.
And to take that really seriously. Yeah. Some of you maybe saw my son on Sunday at Eucharist. We were standing in the back when everyone started to go up for communion, and he's going, like he really wanted to go, and I can hardly wait to see his godparents to tell them this story, you know, because we were careful to pick people for whom that was a serious responsibility. Yeah. Then this is a Sunday school class. It doesn't just end there at the font, but that although women haven't always had a professional role, haven't had special training, one of the things that they have done is to teach. Not just to learn in those Bible studies of their own, but also to teach. In the Lutheran Church in particular, we have had instruction leading up to confirmation, and I would urge you to think about confirmation as basic theological education. It's something that has been available. Even when women haven't had access to advanced theological education, they have had this beginning point that the most fundamental things have been taught to them and have been admitted into at least full spiritual membership, if not given the franchise. I don't have a picture to illustrate this, but the money that women have given didn't all go to missions. Often it went to the congregations. There's a little poem. It's a very snide poem that appears across the denominations, and it has a little refrain about, we couldn't afford this, and so we asked the ladies' aid. We couldn't afford that, and so we asked the ladies' aid. And when we get to heaven, we'll have to admit to St. Peter that we had to ask the ladies' aid. This has been a bad thing, I think, that women have had to use their money as a way to buy membership rights, as a way to have a voice. Yeah. It has screwed up our understanding of membership and responsibility. That women say, we need a new organ. And the church council says, no, we don't need a new organ. And the women say, well, here's some money. Buy it. That something's wrong there. Right? It's good that they bought the organ. It's good that they used the money. It's good that they took responsibility. But the consequence has not been good. Right? That somehow having money is how you get influence in the church. That's not right. That's another one of those. Let's look at the past and see what we can learn about how to do it better. Women have sung, played the organ, provided music, hadn't been able to be worship leaders, haven't been able to be the preacher, haven't been able to serve communion. They got to make the wafers and fix, you know, before church you're allowed to go behind the altar rail, but not during. And we need to balance those things to say, on the one hand, that wasn't right, and on the other hand, to say, but look what they did. Look what they did. And continue to do. Here's another. This is the artist who painted this altar painting. Lots of ways that women have made contribution locally as well as nationally. Sometimes with very ordinary skills like sewing, and sometimes with extraordinary skills like this painting. Then as we come to the mid-20th century, there is again a push for women to have public leadership roles. And this time, it's coming a little more from the outside. What's going on in society? If I can be the president of IBM, why can't I be a pastor? You know? What's going on there? It came earliest in the churches that had the greatest revival influence and latest in the churches that have the higher view of the clergy. I could unpack that a little more, but I think you get intuitively what I'm saying. Lutherans in 1970, both the ALC and the LCA, the first American Lutheran woman bishop last spring, April Larson, and a lovely, wonderful story April told when she was up here this summer, I just have to tell you, even though I know we're getting over time. She said the person who nominated her to be bishop in her synod did so because she saw April's song leading and said, I want that woman to be my bishop. I think it's a wonderful metaphor for the role of leadership. Okay, so here's the Philadelphia 11, the first 11 Episcopalian women who were ordained irregularly. There's some clergy numbers. We don't need to look at those. Here's Rosemary Radford Ruther. I put her up here to stand for all the reformation, all the reformation that's now going on in the last decades, because women have moved into new roles and have begun to ask new questions. And that influences the way then that we look at our past. What we find when we look at our past is something very mixed, that there have been barriers and limits, and that those barriers and limits have been overcome, that women's gifts have been refused and wasted, and women's lives have been wounded. But we also find many women whose lives have been given meaning and purpose by what they have given in